This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Hey, my nephew just up and left the house, so I need a couple of droids to work the moisture farm. You got any?
Over there, in the media corner.
Nice selection.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Hello, everybody, and this is Technorama for November 23rd. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thank you for joining us. And if you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving your time to us. Chuck Tomasi's off this week. He's on assignment tonight, and we'll get into that later. I'm Craig Stepp, and with me filling in is Thomas Gideon, the command line himself. How are you, Thomas?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw some of your trip that you went on, and I was like, oh, he's just got to get on and talk about that. So I thought I'd invite you on. So what's been going on?
Oh, a lot of travel. The trip was just the most recent one. Twice to Europe in the last couple of months, and once out to the West Coast. Once more out to Europe in a couple of weeks, and all for the purposes of keeping an open internet, and we'll talk more about that when we talk about my last trip.
Yeah. So coming up in this episode, we have farming robots, we have more video games becoming movies, and of course, Thomas is going to talk about his trip to and about the EU hackathon. That's easy to say, right?
He never calls the help desk. He doesn't listen to podcasts. They listen to him. He can recite the original Star Wars trilogy, word for word, reproducing the sound effects with his armpits. He is the most interesting geek in the world.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to Technorama. Stay geeky, my friend.
Everybody, and welcome back. And I don't actually have the chat room up. I didn't really announce that we're going to have anything, so I hope they're not in there changing their handles.
I have the chat room up, and no, apparently only the most diehard of the diehards are in there. So, and me.
Oh, the bots, the chat bots.
Yes, it's just me and a bunch of chat bots.
Well, all right, so we have a couple of birthdays, and I'm going to go back just a little. Well, I don't think I need to go back any. I think we were caught up. So on the 22nd, we have Tom Pose, our friend from California. And on the 25th, we have Lane Williams, who did the Missing Alert podcast, which I think he changed it into an app, more or less. I don't know if it's on Android and iPhone, but I know it's on the iPhone. On the 26th, we have Joni. We have not heard from in a long time. Hope she's all right. If you are, call in. And on the 27th, we have Brad P. from NJ, who does the Whole Lot of Nonsense podcast, which I think he's participating in the Nano Podmo. So, because I keep seeing posts from him every day. So, that's pretty cool. So, if you have a birthday, go and put it on the birthday wiki, and there's links to that in the show notes. And I think you just go to chuckchat.com/wiki. It'll take you right there. And normally we have the live stream. So if you happen to be around on Sunday nights at 9:30, like now, you can come and participate in the chat room that we were just talking about and change your handle too, just like everybody else. So, all right. And with that, we're going to check out On This Day in History. On this day in history for November 23rd, 2011, In 1889, the first jukebox goes into operation in the Palace Royale Saloon in San Francisco.
In 1936, the first edition of Life is published.
And in 1955, the Cocos Island, are transferred from the control of the United Kingdom to Australia.
In 1963, the BBC broadcasts the first ever episode of Doctor Who, starring William Hartnell, which is the world's longest-running science fiction drama.
That's my stunt screwdriver.
It used to be my... Oh, I've got one in my drawer.
Let's see, you get one.
Had I known.
In 1976, Apnus... I know, Jocks. Jocks. Jocks Mayol. I'm going to chop up these names all over the place. Is the first man to reach the depth of 100 meters undersea without breathing equipment. That's impressive.
Ooh, free diving. Cool. Yeah. In 1990, the first all-woman expedition to the South Pole, 3 Americans, 1 Japanese, and 12 Russians, sets off from Antarctica on the first leg of a 70-day, 1,287-kilometer ski trek.
And in 2001, the Convention of Cybercrime is signed in Budapest, Hungary. And also, we got birthdays going out to you. In 1553, Prospero Alpini, Italian physician and botanist, was born.
In 1616, John Wallace, English mathematician.
And in 1715, Pierre Charles Lemonnier.
I don't think that's right.
I don't think that's right either. Monnier, there you go. French astronomer is born.
In 1869, Valdemar Poulsen, a Danish engineer, was born.
And in 1887, Henry Mosley.
Yeah, that's what I read too.
Mosley is an English physicist, and he was born as well. And that's the way it was on this day in history for November 2nd, 23rd, 2011. All right, here we go. Good news, everyone. Yeah, I'll just throw that in there. So, you know, on this show, of course, we like robots, right? You like robots, mm-hmm. right? Don't you?
Yeah, I like robots. Yeah. Robots are pretty cool.
Yeah, this is, this guy was posting, talking about, as soon as I pull the website up, over on Suicide Robots, they had an article about some farming robots. And I'll kind of read the little once over here. Wired's Eric Smalley has an awesomely titled article about Massachusetts-based startup Harvest Automation. And they're testing a small farming robot to work in nurseries in horticulture industry, which is kind of neat. It says the Harvest Automation robots are knee-high wheeled machines. Each robot has a gripper and grasping pots, a deck for carrying pots, and an array of sensors to keep track of where it is and what's on the ground around it. Hmm. Teams of robots zip around the nursery field single-mindedly, pacing and grouping plants. Think WALL-E without the doe's eyes personality. Huh, that's kind of neat. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I do like that they worked in a reference to the 1972 very depressing sci-fi classic Silent Running, because mm-hmm. that's actually one of the things that occurred to me in reading along as you read that out loud. And then the other thing was, you know, I mean, robots are cool, and don't get me wrong, I'm all for like more robots. You know, I for one welcome our future robot overlords. But what nursery is like so big and so unmanageable that they actually need to deploy a fleet of robots? I have to wonder.
Well, I'm thinking if it was in the United States, you know, this is doing the jobs that they want the illegals to do, right? We don't want to do it ourselves.
I suppose that's one way of looking at it.
Well, I guess if you had a large nursery to kind of, you know, you could use these to manage everything, make it, maybe you could expand your, you know, your capacity because you got robots running around doing stuff too.
Sure, I guess. And maybe, you know, the jobs you displace from the people that are weeding and watering can go towards maintaining the robots.
Yeah. Yeah, all of a sudden they're computer joggies.
Yeah. IT everywhere, man.
Yeah. I thought about the same thing, too, right when I was thinking of Silent Running before they got to the before I read that, and I kept thinking, "Oh, don't try to eject the pods and you know blow up the blow them up."
Huey, Dewey, Louie. Yeah.
I love that movie. It is depressing, but
it holds a special place around here because my wife's dad is a fan of a lot of 70s era sci-fi, and, mm-hmm. and he loves it a lot and made her watch it growing up. And then I was introduced to it after meeting her, and I went back with her to rewatch all these movies that her dad showed her when she was a kid. And yeah, you know, you rewatch them and it's just, you know, there's a time and a place for a lot of the stuff. You know, I think I can appreciate kind of the environmental message of mm-hmm. that movie and how powerful and how cool it must have been. But now, yeah, it's a little depressing, so much so that what cartoon were we watching? It might have been the Simpsons or something in that vein that had mm-hmm. The cliched ending of every 1970s movie ever. You know, it's like nonsensical and depressing, and it just mm-hmm. kind of fades out.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, this is one of the movies that that I actually stayed up. I was spending the night at a friend's house, and we stayed up a lot later than we were supposed to, you know, and watching movies to the middle of the night or way past the middle of the night. And this is one of them. And that's why I guess I kind of – it holds a little special place in my heart for that. But yeah, so as soon as I saw this, like, it looks like one of the robots moving the plants around on the spaceship.
So. Yeah, all you need is that many-wheeled buggy that the protagonist was zipping around all the domes.
With the six wheels?
Was it six? I seem to remember more, but it might just be like every time I remember it, I'm adding more wheels to this buggy. It's like it had more wheels than it really strictly needed, especially like in a clean environment out in space.
Yeah, I thought it was six. It could have been eight, but yeah, you're right. Remember, there was a point when there were a couple of guys were just screwing around, chasing each other, and they were spinning it around, doing donuts, I think.
Yeah, what else are you going to do in a big greenhouse space station out, you know, just do donuts in your in your little 12, 18, 24-wheeled buggy.
That's right. Go joy riding in the spaceship.
That's what the extra wheels are for donuts.
Yeah, for donuts. And speaking of, well... No, that wasn't going to work. I was going to try and tie in the Death Star with donuts, but oh well.
That's no moon. It's a donut.
That's no ring around Saturn. No, but anyway, kind of segueing into our hacks and strange stories. Tonight, I have this really cool special article, and it's this guy took these Legos and built Docking Bay 327, the one on the Death Star when you see the Millennium Falcon get sucked into from the tractor beam. He built this sucker from scratch, and it's amazing. He's got LEDs all over it. The whole thing is detailed to, you know, I started to say from wall to wall, pretty much. And I think I read in the article here, he was, he'd used his Lego designer and actually planned all this out. And so he was able to order the parts and put it all together. So it's pretty amazing.
I'm constantly amazed at what comes out of the mock community. These my own creation models that people come up with and document to just a high degree with a great amount of care. And this is certainly a case where, you know, you get the kind of the overview shot, what you were talking about, like from wall to wall. That looks like, you know, you're looking down on the actual set. And then all of these, you know, like a dozen or so photos that push in and show, you know, all the little greeblies and the amazing detail that went into this. And even some of the gags he kind of worked in that are a lot of fun.
You know, one of them I noticed was had a stormtrooper falling over and it had a sign, caution, wet floor.
Yeah, so stormtroopers are very clumsy. Bad shots and very clumsy, you know, falling down the elevator shaft that doesn't have a safety railing. Apparently safety is not important on the Death Star.
These stormtroopers are not effective at all. What was some of the other detail you found? One of the guys was falling in cargo...
The elevator shaft actually appears to be operational. There's with the floor of the lift down. Yeah, there's a one of the stormtroopers is falling, like in the running firefight when they're running towards the Falcon to board, while the climactic battle between Obi-Wan and Darth Vader is going on. And there's actually another shot that shows the lift. He's even built the lift, so the lift is coming up with the stormtroopers and the sensor package that they used to sweep through the Falcon when it was first captured. I thought that was pretty cool.
It is cool. And I watched, I don't know if you you ended up watching the video at all, but on the video, he shows all the LED lights and they're all over the place, even on the back of the Falcon for the engines, and on the floor, they got like the running lights, you know, for somebody to come in and land. Yeah. And the elevator slides up, like you were talking about, it slides up and it slides back down. It's pretty impressive. So if you go to the article, be sure to go all the way down past the all the words.
Skip the words. Go to the pretty and, pictures.
Words. Yeah, and go to the pictures and see. There's a video, I think, at even beyond.
Pretty close to the bottom.
Those pictures.
And, but right before the comments. There's one picture. I don't know. I mean, there's some pretty cool stuff beyond the ship lighting and the space lighting. He's actually lit the saber battle, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But closer to the top, there's one that you know, you were talking about the stormtrooper slipping with the caution wet sign, and like two after that, yeah. I'm not sure what this is supposed to be. There's like a niche in the wall, and it's filled with translucent blue pieces, and there's just a skeleton, like. Some stormtrooper had a mishap and nobody bothered to clean it up, and now there's just a skeleton there. I don't know what that's supposed to be.
Nobody cleaned it up. I was joking earlier that Lucas came in and edited the
it's a CGI Force Ghost.
He's actually in the Blu-ray.
It's an extra one.
Yeah.
They even have a mouse droid in one. I thought that was really cool. There's a shot down the side of the Falcon, and it's showing the detail on the back wall of the hangar and some of the pieces, and you've got a couple of stormtroopers and an officer walking around the deck, and you can just make out there's a little teeny mouse droid. I thought that was really cool. We always like spotting the mouse droids in the movies.
Oh, yeah, there's one. Yeah, that is pretty cool. So, all right. Enough about him and his unemployment. Apparently, he's got plenty of time to do this kind of stuff. But actually, you know, I want to say one other thing. I think it would be really cool to have the job as like one of the master creators, you know, one of the master Lego guys.
Yeah.
You ever seen those guys?
I think we all entertained moments as kids and even maybe not as kids of just, man, I'd rather be building Legos for a living right now.
I think my dream job would be building Legos while being employed by Google.
Those two things are not mutually exclusive. I've been inside of Google. There's an awful lot of Legos. I'm surprised they get anything done.
I'm surprised they get anything done either, because whenever you see stories about, hey, here's the life at Google, they're all eating free lunch and playing pool or something, you know, or playing hacky sack over in the corner. When do they work?
Just must make them super productive. I don't know. Somehow it works for them.
For the 10 minutes they're at their desk.
they're really refreshed that they're able to cram an entire day's worth of work in 10 minutes.
That's amazing. Oh, well, the corporate life, or the anti-corporate life, or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, in the media corner tonight, I have a couple of things, actually three things. And the first one is this lost Mark Hamill video interview, which I actually watched most of it. There's a lot of clips from Star Wars in it that eats up a lot of the time. So, you know, if you want to skip around and watch the interview, you can kind of do that. But it's kind of neat to watch Mark Hamill try to explain the plot of Star Wars. And he's, you can tell the host is a fanboy because he's one of those early Star Wars guys that he's probably seen it about five times, and he's trying to contain himself while he's talking to Mark Hamill. But it's kind of neat to watch. Have you ever watched any of these old interviews with the actors?
Not this one in particular, but yeah, it is always interesting to see. There was one I saw some time ago that I think made the rounds like this one did. Someone posted to YouTube that was more of the cast. It wasn't just Hamill. It was also Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher. And just, I mean, you're of course, you know, you're used to seeing them in the movie, and they're ageless, you know, for however many thousands of times you've watched the Star Wars movies. But actually seeing him just kind of talking normally really brings it home how young they were when they made the film and how long ago, really, at this point, the movie came out.
Yeah. And speaking of young, this is his first. Now, Mark Hamill mentioned that he had done a lot of TV before Star Wars, which I don't know. I can't recall anything, but he may have. But he was talking. The guy asked him, said, "Well, about there was speculation about how much money he's made now that Star Wars is a huge hit." He said, "Money? I didn't get into acting for the money." Talk about a windfall. I bet.
Yeah, really. I mean, if that's like the one thing that you're going to be famous for, and I'm not saying that that's the case with Hamill. He's had I think he's had a couple of additional swings at bat. I know you and I both are big fans of a lot of the voice acting that he's done. That he's I think in many of our minds now, like the canonical voice of the Joker, the animated Joker, and just did such a great job under Bruce Timm. With the Batman cartoons that came out some years back, where he was lending his voice to that, and I'm still amazed to hear him crop up doing guest voice acting work and doing cameos all over the place. And he seems to be one of those ones that, you know, for the amount of time that he's been in the industry, and to your point about like what a monumental kind of a milestone Star Wars is to geeks of a certain age, and now, you know, you and I both being geek dads to our kids. I think he has a really good sense of humor about himself. You know, I think he really, really enjoys what he does and doesn't just hang his hat on just that, but uses that to get a lot of fun opportunities to go out and really just enjoy himself.
And why not at this point? You know, what's the harm in it? Yeah. I just saw him on Chuck. Did you see that?
No, I don't watch Chuck. I thought Chuck was on assignment.
Oh, no. No,
well, not that Chuck. Oh, the TV show Chuck.
Yeah, he was filling in for Chuck Tomasi. No, he was actually kind of a bad guy. They kind of played it up, but he was only on there for like the first 10 minutes of the show, like before the music, you know, kind of a little setup, you know. Mm-hmm. So he was a bad guy, and he was on there for a few minutes. It was kind of cool to see him, and that was it. But yeah, you're right, doing those kind of things. Remember, he was on Jay and Silent Bob Straight Back.
That's right. Sure was. So,
yeah, why not? I mean, I can appreciate an actor being willing to, you know, belittle himself a little bit in a role just for fun of it, you know, than people that take themselves too seriously for the art.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that I have a lot more respect for somebody that can laugh at themselves. And then when they do turn around and they do something that they're more invested in, that's more serious, I think that's in the back of your mind that this is somebody who really enjoys their craft. Is so whether they're doing something dramatic or they're doing something silly like that scene in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And for those who've seen it, yeah, that whole thing from start to finish is rather silly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, any number of other things that he's done, that's just clearly, you know, somebody really enjoying the earned fame that he accrued from Star Wars.
Yeah. And I want to add one more thing about him is, you know, when I watched Batman, of course, who reads the credits? I never thought to read the credits. And then one day I found out that he did the voice for the Joker. I was like, you got to be kidding me. I had no idea. Yeah. Very talented guy. All right, so moving right along. Speaking of movies, see, there's a good segue. remember the game Rampage?
Oh, I sure do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're making a movie about it. Or not about it, per se, but I guess based on it. That's more accurate. They're making a movie about the game Rampage, which, you know, had such an expansive plot.
It did, actually. It did. It totally did. You make fun of it, but I remember, you know, when the monsters were being introduced, that there was, I mean, it was, I remember they have a video of one of the newer versions of the game. It's, you know, a little bit more kind of 3D modeled, and it actually, I played that on a friend's 360 or later vintage console, and it actually looked a little like kind of claymation, which was kind of fun, brought a campy angle to it. But I remember playing the upright in the arcade, the 8-bit upright in the arcade, and they actually did have not full cutscenes, but they did have stills that kind of had, you know, a little bit more about, you know, and they were very silly and very tongue in cheek, and they weren't very deep or anything like that. But there was a little more sense of story to it than that of, you know, why somebody, you know, what industrial accident led to somebody becoming a giant lizard monster or giant ape monster or giant wolf monster. I mean, if you think about it, a game like Rampage that at least has that element to it makes more sense than, like, oh, I don't know, Battleship.
Okay, you got a point.
I mean, I saw the trailer for that. You know, the last movie we took the kids to, we saw the trailer for that, and we were excited for about 15 seconds until it started to dawn on us what it was, and we're like, how do you get a story out of Battleship?
Aliens take the ships and they kind of pit them, the fleet against themselves. Is that what it was?
No, it was, there were just like, there were alien ships coming up out of the water, and it was very, you know, Michael Bay-esque with the, you know, very grand scale and huge soundtrack and lots of explosions and special effects. And, you know, you just have that kind of visceral reaction when you're starting to kind of bounce in your seat and get excited. And then you realize, wait a minute, this is what everybody's been talking about. This is the, this is the board game movie that everybody was making fun of. And you're like, how can you have any kind of sane plot about this?
I remembered Aliens being in there somewhere, but yeah, you're right. It's like making a game off Life. Wait, that would have better plot than Battleship, right?
I think so.
Jumanji.
there's a beginning, middle, and end to Life. Jumanji. Yeah.
Sure. You know, thinking of board game movies, I think Jumanji was okay, but I like Zathura. Did you ever watch that?
Yeah, I did really enjoy that. That's, again, as a geek dad, you know, that's, especially with two boys, that seeing a couple of brothers kind of come to that point where they kind of find an accommodation in their rivalry and the older brother kind of fed up with the younger brother. We enjoyed that a lot. And it was a little better paced in terms of the adaptation versus Jumanji. And it was a little tighter. I think it was more enjoyable. Plus, I think we're also in this household anyway, we're bigger space geeks than we are like jungle animal geeks. I don't know if that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so it's fun seeing the rhinos and the elephants and the monkeys and all that kind of stuff. And it was a very nice kind of stylized CGI of the animals in Jumanji. But space around here, doesn't matter what it is, anything space related trumps everything else.
Yeah, of course. And what I thought was funny was I had that robot in there, and it kind of looked a little bit Iron Man-esque, and it had Jon Favreau was actually directed Zathura too.
Oh wow! Oh okay, I'm gonna have to go back and rewatch that again. I that would make a lot of sense to kind of relating that to like Ironmonger in the first movie. You know, just the big,
I don't know,
sort of clunky, course, dark looking.
I mean, there was enough time where I don't think it was planned, but it sure does make sense.
If he's got input into the production design and it's kind of his directorial eye that's putting it together, I could see a certain kind of a trajectory connecting the two together. I didn't realize that was Favreau. I'm a big fan. That also might explain why I found the pacing of Zathura to be a lot better, especially with the time that came out and I saw it with the kids. They were a bit younger, and so it was something that really kept their interest a lot better.
Yeah. Well, we'll be looking for the trailer for Rampage.
Oh, man. just as long as I can play the giant werewolf. That was always my character, man.
You know, I never quite figured out how he fit in there.
Who cares? He's a giant werewolf. This is the problem you have with this. Is there's a giant monkey and a giant lizard, and you're fine with that. And you're like, I don't know. The werewolf, to me, just doesn't fit. Smashing buildings, throwing tanks at each other, eating dynamite and shooting fire out their mouths. This is all fine with you, but it's like,
so you think I'm overthinking it just a tad?
Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. Well, anyway, moving from that to old magazines and stuff, you know, back in the day when you used to get like Computes Gazette, you know, I type in the programs in the back of it to actually get my Commodore to do stuff. And even in the Apple, we had a couple of Apples at work. I was working back in the day.
Uphill both ways, kids.
I used to compute
uphill both ways.
back at school, we had an Apple IIe, and I would take programs and stuff in there and type it in. Well, anyway, this website, the SF Weekly, they have a spotlight on a couple of those magazines. And apparently they do this often. I have this the first time I've seen there's an article here. But they're talking about the People's Computer Company. Actually, it's funny because I used to work for a company called People's Computer Warehouse. So when I saw this, I went, wait a minute. But it's not related. And anyway, they have some articles in there talking about doing ASCII art. And they have some, of course, they run through all the different things that they spotlighted in the thing. And say there's a review on the visible solar system from Commodore, Dungeons of the Algebra Dragons.
I like the editorial here. I'm no math whiz, but I suspect Algebra Dragons can only be hurt with imaginary numbers.
I was thinking more like, hey, this is fun. Oh, wait, I learned something. Oh,
damn it. Damn. It canceled out some of my fun.
Yeah. So if you scroll down here a little bit, there have a couple of pictures of like an X-Wing and the Stormtrooper. And I like the, like you said, the commentary. That's the scariest Stormtrooper in italicized. That's the scariest Stormtrooper is an italicized Stormtrooper. And he's, it's that iconic picture of him shooting the gun.
Yeah.
There's Darth Vader sitting there.
This is crazy. I mean, this is, I remember some of the first ASCII art I saw, and I actually think it was way later than this, because I remember being much more impressed, you know, that there was, kind of texture and some depth to it. So this is like mm-hmm. maybe some of the earliest examples of the form. It's pretty crazy. It's all the same, you know, yeah. Very creative. Some of the things people come up with, even as primitive as some of these are.
Oh, yeah.
Very immediately recognizable.
Well, you know, what's funny about ASCII art, just when you think you've seen it all, like you said, you know, from a distance, I've seen, at the Computer History Museum, we saw the Mona Lisa. It was printed out with ASCII art. But I've seen things that I printed out, look at it from a distance, and it looks semi-real, you know. But, and then you've seen the... Then just when you think you've seen it all is when I was saying, then you see them where they did the movie, the Star Wars, they redid Star Wars in ASCII art. Yeah. You just tell that to the server and you can watch
something like that. I know there's a codec out there that'll take just a regular video stream and will actually convert on the fly in ASCII art. It's pretty impressive. And then there was a Doom mod. That was an ASCII art front end to Doom too. That was pretty impressive. It was surprisingly playable.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
You know, the frame rate was how do you even calculate frame rate? You're not talking about the entire frame. You're, you know, rendering every individual character. You know, it's like how many characters per second did you get on your computer with ASCII Doom?
Yeah, characters per second. That's like back in the day, you could judge the speed of the computer by doing a directory listing. Wow, yep. That was fast. So anyway, they you should go through here and look at some of the they got a couple ads for like the Franklin computer, which looks suspiciously like an Apple too. They have some ads in there and some cartoons and stuff from the magazine. It's kind of cool to go back and look at. And you know, when I reshared this on Google+, and one of my followers chimed up and he said, as Bill Klump from like I said, over at Google+, he said, I used to have this specific issue, the magazine, not an issue. Unfortunately, it was it and the old copies of my computer shopper from the 80s, some of which were up to 800 pages plus, were destroyed when the roof sprung a leak. Oh, at my parents' house in Florida, because the apartment where the ex and I were living at the time didn't have room to store them. A lot of the old computer magazines were fun reads, especially when they tried to compare the old computers you could buy or build from companies such as Commodore, Radio Shack, or Texas Instruments, Sega, Activision, blah, 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 and other computer makers who have faded into the sands of time, along with parts for building on your own IBM PC, XT, and ATs. So the reason I put that in there is because I remember I had forgotten about them because I don't have any. Those old computer shoppers. Have you ever seen any of those things? Those things were ginormous.
Yeah. I think I saw them right as they were on the way out, and they were. It was pretty crazy. It was like a Auto Trader, but for computers and computer geeks.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I remember it. It was like you could buy parts, you know, an RLL controller for your hard drive when they didn't make them anymore. You could always find that kind of stuff in there. Yeah, it was kind of neat. I never bought anything from there. Did you?
No, no. I can't say as I did. I think by the time I was old enough to get into buying my own parts, it was the golden ages of the CompUSA and Micro Center and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can actually go into the store. And maybe even just a little bit before that, like the local computer shop where, you know, you go in and there's the two or three guys that are always in the back playing the latest video games or whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, the limited selection.
Yeah. So I kept my teeth on that. Like I said, that Apple II. And then, of course, when I got my own Commodore, I was in heaven. So what did you cut your teeth on?
Well, in school, we had a small lab with an Atari 400 and an 800. And I always forget to think about that because it was school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you were making the joke about, oh, no, I learned something. We were always learning something. You know, we're like having fun and it's like, oh, but this is school. But like at home, before we had personal computers, the personal computers we eventually ended up getting were PC clones.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, we had green screen terminals. Hooked up with 300 baud modems. My dad even had like a quote unquote portable acoustic coupling modem for when he was on the road.
It was just
massive briefcase, and you open it up and it's got the two big foam cups, so you could dial in and slam the handset into it real
you
quick.
You go to my PC and I'm just kidding.
You'd think so, but oddly, no.
Yeah.
No. So the when my friends were into like these magazines, I was dialing into a Data General Mini to play the Adventure in the Colossal Cavern and Telengard and stuff like that. Go Fish, crazy.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's good times, man.
Yeah, good times. Uphill both ways in the snow.
Computing, as it should be.
Yeah, my dad. I still remember my dad telling me like how good we had it having the Mini. That when he started his business, or just before he started his business, they were still able to program the ferrite memory cores with a magnet. They could actually physically flip the bits with a magnet. They were big enough at that time. They weren't down to the scale they are today, which is ridiculously small. Mm-hmm. these giant. Dishwasher-sized appliances that were your hard drive, one.
Yeah.
And it had, maybe kilobytes, if that, of storage. So pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, we were when we went to the Computer History Museum, up in the, hanging from the ceiling, it looked like a window frame. And, of course, I was like, what's that? And I guess, oh, that's memory. Because you could see how they had the wires cross-section, and then they had the little ferrite rings all around it, and it was, he was like, I forget how much memory he said that was, but it was ridiculously small for as big as it was.
It's physically 23 and a half bits, Chuck, Craig, whoever you are. 23 and a half bits. Don't ask me about 23. The half bit. We don't like talking about it. It just makes us angry. We couldn't afford 24 bits, but we could only afford 23 and a half.
Budget cuts, had to cut one bit.
Somebody got only halfway through winding the last bit, and there you have it. It could only be set to on, and can never turn it off.
Yeah, it was on a Friday evening, so it took off.
What's that? It's like never buy your computer on a Monday or a Friday.
That's right. That's exactly right. All right, and so with that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back to talk about Thomas. Talk about him. Talk with him about his trips. Recent trip to the EU hackathon. We'll be right back.
This is not the set of numbers that you're looking for. 157, 163, 225, 151, 101.
What is that, today's winning lotto numbers from Bruce Barr? Suddenly we've got Dr. Floyd's Imagination Nation Ranger secret message crossing over with Technorama. Does anybody know what's going on in this show anymore? Because I'm lost and it's our show.
That's the fun part.
Mr. Turtle, how many keystrokes does it take to get to the Ring Zero center of an operating system, Pop?
I never found out without baiting. Ask Mr. Owl.
Mr. Owl, How many keystrokes does it take to get to the ring zero center of an operating system pop?
Let's find out. One, two, three, three.
How many licks does it take to get to the ring zero center of an operating system pop? The world may never know. All right, and we're back. So, Thomas, tell us about your trip. It looked pretty interesting. I saw a video of it, and maybe I'll put a link to that. But, yeah, tell us about what you've been up to.
Yeah, sure. I started a new job around the start of the summer, end of the spring, working for a not-for-profit here in Washington, D.C. It's actually a nonpartisan think tank. I work for the technology program, so I'm working on public policy. I'm working on projects that are aimed at kind of bringing open technology, open data, open source into discussions around how we formulate laws and rules and whatnot. And in this instance, the most recent trip to Brussels to go to the EU Parliament was for a hackathon that was organized to take place in part in the actual Parliament building, the first such event, the first hackathon to do so. And there were two tracks. I was involved with one. The other was for the global transparency track that was organized by – the whole thing was sponsored by Google. There were some media sponsors and others. So the global transparency report folks from Google, the ones who put out the regular report that shows – what countries are asking for what data from them, what they're complying with, you know, what that comparative kind of picture of how transparent Google is and what sorts of requests that they're handling from law enforcers and others. Mm-hmm. The track I was involved with on the other side, it was for internet quality. And the reason why I was involved is because for most of my time is spent on a project called Measurement Lab. And this is a collaboration also with Google, but with a bunch of other partners from the not-for-profit space, like My Employers New America, also from academia, from Princeton, from Internet 2, a whole bunch of folks all coming together dedicated to running longitudinal network measurements. We've been running for 3 years now. We have over 400 terabytes of data. And that and the source code for all our tools we brought to the hackathon to encourage teams that crafted projects on the internet quality side to base those on our data and on our source code. So that was a really, to this point, once it'll be amongst a group of hackers in the EU Parliament building, talking to MEPs, talking to journalists, talking to my colleagues from European NGOs and civil society there. And the video you're talking about, there was a film crew that was around the whole time. The hackathon ran for 24 hours pretty much straight. Actually, I think when all was said and done, it was more like 25 with the opening and closing ceremony at either end and then a reception after the closing ceremony. So we were a few hours at the beginning and the end in the Parliament building and then 23 hours straight of coding over in Google's offices nearby.
Because some of those guys didn't look like they quite made it to the reception.
No, I think most of them did. I think we had one guy who turned in early, turned his submission early and left at like the 4 hour mark or the 6 hour mark, and nobody saw him ever again. But everybody else worked really hard. In the video, what Craig's referring to, I keep doing that. You're Craig. I know you're Craig.
Thank you.
It even says that on my Skype. What Craig's referring to in the video is the video does a really good job of kind of capturing the feeling of what it was like to be involved. And so there's a lot of scenes of these various programmers actually working on their visualizations, working on their tools for both the tracks that I described. And there's also kind of interwoven into that to give you a sense that they really did work continuously over the course of 23 hours. They're sacked out. There were more people sacked out at more points than even the video let on because this was in the Google offices, so they had a massage chair. I don't think that And yeah, people would take a nap in the it totally makes sense. You're stressed out. You need to kind of unwind. You need to relax for a bit. There were people who just kind of sack out there for an hour or so. There were these cool like pod chairs, almost like from the quiz scene in the original Men in Black movie where. The purpose of these chairs is they kind of help isolate sound a little bit. So it was kind of a nice space also to kind of sit back when you needed a break and you needed a little bit of quiet. Maybe you take your laptop over there if you want to keep working or do something else. But
did you get one of those things?
Did I get one like as a door prize to take back with me?
Yeah, you won.
No.
I was just wondering if you got in one.
No, I did. I did. I rather enjoyed it because, you know, as you imagine with we had about a dozen teams working across both tracks. It's not that it was raucous per se, but there was kind of a constant hubbub going on. So especially like when I needed to catch up on some work email in the more sane hours of the hackathon. Although that was also kind of odd being 6 hours ahead of all of my colleagues back in D.C. So. I was responding to correspondences from them, it was already offset by 6 hours, and then I stayed up. I didn't stay up the whole way through. I was not on one of the teams. I was there to help answer questions about the measurement lab source code and the measurement lab data.
Oh, so you didn't do any coding yourself?
Well, I did, but not related to the hackathon. I did some stuff for work and a little bit of DevOps for work and stuff like that. Yeah. But no, hanging around to help answer any questions that they had. We put together an FAQ up on the measurementlab.net website for them in advance. And I take it as a compliment that the questions I got were very targeted and were not answered in the FAQ. They were things that were very specific to the source code where they really did need some technical expertise. And we didn't get a lot of those questions either. And I think that really speaks to the quality of the applicants that we got. So we got some amazing visualizations. You'll see some of those in the 7.5 minute video as well. Some really cool programs out of it.
Now, is this related to, just real quick, it's like quality of service type stuff to make sure you're getting what you're supposed to be getting. Like, I'm just taking a stab here. Are we talking like to see if your ISP is shaping your traffic like they shouldn't be, the kind of thing?
Yes. Well, one of the two tools, Glasnost, is that's what it focuses in on. It's looking at different forms of traffic interference. Not shaping per se. It actually came out of the original kerfuffle with Comcast interfering with BitTorrent. So Glasnost originally was designed to detect that specific form of interference with BitTorrent. But the researchers who worked on it have since generalized it so that you can actually write your own scripts to simulate different application protocols and run tests to see if your ISP is interfering with that. And there's somewhere between a half dozen or a dozen protocols already available. If you go to the test on the measurementlab.net website, you can see the list of all the different protocols that it simulates. But that's not all that Measurement Lab does. On the other side, the other tool we brought with us, NDT, is like a speed test on steroids. And it really, it kind of gets a little bit into
the way it sounds, speed on
speed
steroids.
Speed test on, it's a methamphetamine of speed test. No. what I mean is like you go to speedtest.net, you go to Ookla, and you get a couple of numbers. You get your upload speed and your download speed over a certain amount of time. NDT does that, and it will perform that calculation, and it will show you your upload and your download speed. But it does so much more. It's designed around the Web 100 project, which is an instrumentation package. So it's a set of patches you can apply to BSD over. And then it will capture over 150 variables about a network session. So you can we capture those so that people can do passive analysis after the fact. We use some of those to calculate and factor into not just the speed test outcome, but also look at agnostic issues like the jitter on your connection, the latency, the round trip time, stuff like that. If you call up your ISP and you're patient enough, or you've got a friend who works in network engineering, this is the kind of tool used to do some really cool heavy lifting sort of diagnostic of your internet connection. So on one level, it does kind of answer one of the other questions you were getting out there, where this data in aggregate can help paint a picture of where ISPs are providing the what they say they're providing, where maybe they're not living up to what it is that they're advertising. But it does so much more than that. It really mm-hmm. every time a test is run, it captures a very comprehensive view of what that network connection looks like and what it's doing at that time. And then that data is openly available for things like this hackathon. So there were no issues of getting people to stay. There was no question that they could have access to this data. It's all licensed CC0. It's out there in the public domain. Anybody can do anything with it, whether they're academics or they're hackers. That's or cool. They're just interested people who love data and love to do mm-hmm. things with data. It's out there. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest data set of its kind out there that's licensed in this way and accessible for people to make use of.
That's cool. No, the only reason I brought up the Comcast type issue is I remember you talking about it about 4, 5, 6 months ago on your podcast, I think. You were bringing it up about somebody wanting to gather all that data and see what your ISPs are doing.
Well, there's a variety of initiatives in this space. There's another one in the U.S. here in cooperation with the FCC, and that's a partner of Measurement Labs. Samnos is a small firm in the U.K., fairly expert at network measurement. I'm trying to remember what specifically I might have been referring to and talking about Comcast, because the stuff that I work on in terms of network measurement and then the kind of advocacy and communications work I do based on that isn't specific to any particular ISP. I know some of this was prodded by specific incidents, like the Glasnost research experiment was originally done in response to Comcast, but it's so much more comprehensive than that. It's really grown into something that really is looking at all of the providers, everywhere that we have servers that we can take decent measurement on the globe. So not just Comcast, who's only here in the U.S., but looking at cable providers, traditional ISPs and telcos. We're starting to get into mobile, which is really exciting. There's a research group at the University of Michigan that just lit up an experiment that's going to be looking at 3D and taking just as comprehensive an approach to measure everything about that. So that's in the that's in the early stages still, and I expect that we'll see maybe about mid-year next year. I wouldn't be surprised, or maybe a little bit later, latter half of next year, if we see a research paper coming out from that group with cool. some interesting findings. I don't hold me to that, because it is academia, and I don't want to speak out of turn.
I'm sorry.
Oh, too late now. But that's my sense, is kind of the usually it's like somewhere in the 6 to 12 month range once these experiments get spun up that you see the researchers actually pull together the data and start to do some analysis and present that in a way that's usually surprisingly accessible. We had what I might have been referring to was the the Shaper Probe experiment, specifically at traffic shaping. And that's out of a research group at Georgia Tech. A lot of awesome network research coming out of Georgia Tech, not just
I want to say I thought you were talking about the debacle with the BitTorrent. People were being denied access to things like that, and it was born out of that because they thought that their ISP was blocking them for certain things or restricting their bandwidth when they said they weren't or weren't open well, the, about the, what the they were doing.
The stuff from 4 to 6 months ago was probably Shaper Probe, and that was just the research paper finally came out from that experiment. And it's not I don't want to misrepresent the research. I can shoot you a link to some of the coverage of that. Ars Technica and some of the other usual kind of tech news sites picked it up and did a pretty good job of kind of synthesizing it down to something that somebody could understand. I actually, just because I'm involved with this, actually dug into the paper. It's fairly crunchy, but it's surprisingly readable if you're patient and you kind of take the time, give yourself some time to work through it. And I won't say that they found necessarily that Comcast was a bad actor or some who is a bad actor. Getting at is that Comcast isn't telling us what they're doing. And it's kind of understandable, why they would not. They see this as kind of competitive intelligence and trade secret and whatnot. But the experiments that we support with Measurement Lab, the experiments that run on this open platform that release their data in an open way and use all open source tools to get at this, we're essentially reverse engineering this data anyway. And we're trying to do this in the most transparent fashion. And we're trying to do it without The point I'm really trying to drive at is without any sort of prejudice or without you know, a predetermined outcome, it's really more, the experiment's really more crafted to say, what's going on here? You know, what does this look like? You know, there really isn't a firm hypothesis that we think something's happening. And that's what the Shaper Probe experiment turned up was, just that, I think, kind of counter to what we might expect with Comcast behavior in this space, is that a lot of the traffic shaping's used for fairly benign purposes. It's not really, you know, maybe it's not being used to the best effect when we talk about kind of congestion and people hogging their more than their fair share bin with or whatever. But by and large, it's really just used to manage the various service tiers. And it's kind of that paper does a good job of explaining why that's so, more so with cable than with other access technologies like fiber or DSL.
Well, cool. All right. Yeah, should be some links and we'll put those in the show notes.
Yeah, cool. Sorry for kind of like taking over and like, you know, letting my day job get the better of your show here. But
No. Actually, you know,
we're all very
on.
Passionate about it. It's a fun project in the sense that it's the one that lets me do all this awesome travel, like for the EU hackathon. Mm-hmm. And we're all very dedicated to just answering these amazingly big questions that nobody has really undertaken in quite this way to try to find answers to before.
No, this is all good stuff. And I always considered you my electronic spiritual advisor. You know, when I want to know more about this, that, or the other, I can go listen to your podcast or kind of ping you about it. And you're always on top of it when it comes to, you know, your rights online or stuff like this, you know, you're talking about. So very cool. And speaking of which, where can everybody go to find out more about you and check out your podcast and stuff?
Sure. The absolute single best place to find out about me, to listen to the podcast, to read my blog, which unfortunately now that my day job is much more strongly coincides with the things that I read and write about, has suffered a little bit. I'm posting as much as I'd like, but you know, everybody says about their blog. But still, the best place to go is thecommandline.net, and you can find all links to all the things that I'm involved with there, including the podcast.
Very cool. All right. Thanks for coming on, and I appreciate you you coming on with me tonight and picking up the slack where Chuck Tomasi is.
I'm not going to touch that. Sure. Instead, I'm going to thank you. I'm going to thank you for inviting me on. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you, Craig.
Very cool. Thanks. And since it's the end of the show, I want to tell you that we appreciate your support, you coming and spending your time and listening to the show. And to show your love, give us a call. You can call us at 206-222-CHAT. That's 2428. Or you can email Chuck and I at technorama@chuckchat.com. And, of course, we're on Twitter and Google+. And there's links to all that on the website. I'm not going to bore you with it here. So if you also want to participate and support the show, we do take donations. We're not above that. And there's you can do a one-time payment, or we do micropayments. We can do that on the website. Or throw us a review in the iTunes store, or I guess Podcast Pickle, Podcast Alley, they're still around, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So any of those podcasting directories, please let everybody know what you think about our podcast, as long as it's positive. So I also want to thank Mad Mar for providing some great blog content, and he's always on the ball. And Ustream for providing our live stream normally. And, of course, in our chat room is provided by ThinStack.net. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech, so you can find out more about friendsintech.com over at friendsintech.com. And we're also affiliated with Farpoint Media, and we're at farpointmedia.com, and they've got tons of great podcasts over there. We encourage you to go check them out. So if you're getting on the show by clicking on the link on the website and just listening online, consider subscribing. You can do it. There's a million ways to do it, and you can get it for free delivered right to you. So if you need more information about that, just drop Chuck or I an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. And don't forget, the best way you can support the show is tell a friend about Technorama. And with that, we're out of here. Binary high five, Thomas.
101.
Soylent Green.